Good morning. Vampire. How are you?
Me, I am very, very well, and well able for any vampire that might appear.
I should have introduced you. This is Dennis McIntyre, who is going to talk to us all about everything Bram Stoker. Very appropriate on the day that's in it. I think it's on Halloween.
Well, I suppose I'd have to say, technically speaking, Stoker and Dracula don't have much to do with Halloween, bar the darkness or whatever, because it's an all-round subject. But it's appropriate, obviously, at Halloween. And I suppose the Dracula figure now is as big as figures come in the area of the occult and, you know, vampirism and indeed all spirits associated with Halloween.
Indeed. But maybe you just give us some of the background on Bram Stoker. Where was he from? Where was he born? You know, what's the family background?
Yeah. Well, Bram's family, we think, originally may have come from the Belgian area. Maybe of Jewish origin, we don't know. They came to England, we think, with William the Conqueror as far back as 1066. And over the years, they came to Ireland through the British Army. Now, by the time Bram was born, the family were established in Ireland about 300 years. Now, he himself, Bram, which is short for Abraham, by the way, and his father had the same name, Abraham. Again, it has a slight biblical touch to it. Bram was born in a place called the Crescent in Clontarf in North Dublin in a very famous year in Irish history, the 1847, the Black 47, the year of the 1 year of the Great Famine. Now, Bram had a strange childhood. He wasn't expected to live. And indeed, when we look at the Dracula figure he created later on, he could be his own version of Dracula in the sense that he came back from the dead several times. Doctors had left him for dead. But the one person who believed in him, as mothers do, was his mother. And she nursed him and minded him and cuddled him, and eventually he didn't actually walk until he was 8 years old. Now, we never did find out what exactly was the problem. You know, many, many theories have been put forward, but we don't know whether it's psychological or that physical, a combination of both. In any case, he eventually walked, and he was real delicate, small, and couldn't go to a normal national primary school. He had to be sent to a private school. But he turned the tables, and he's a good role model for, you know, anybody, particularly children, who might, you know, feel inadequate within themselves, because he himself was, as I say, very delicate, small, and everything else. He went to Trinity College when he was 16, and he grew up to be a big man, 6'2", which was big at any time, and became a top-class athlete, if you don't mind. For a guy who couldn't walk, he won medals at running, walking, swimming, and became an acrobat, if you don't mind. His years at Trinity he enjoyed very much. He then became a civil servant and didn't particularly like the civil service. His real interest in life was drama, and he eventually met a British actor called Henry Irving, who often brought his dramatic touring group from London to Dublin. And Bram did a dramatic column for the then Dublin Evening Mail newspaper, and he praised this Irving, his acting ability, in this column a few times. Irving was a very vain man, and of course his ears went up when he heard that somebody was writing in the paper about how good an actor he was. So the short and long of the story was that he sent for Stoker, who was writing these articles. They met, they got on well, and Irving invited Stoker to become manager of his theatre in London, the Lyceum, and his own manager. And Bram was to spend the rest of his working life, 25 years, with Irving. And that was his main. A lot of people think he was obsessed with Dracula or not. Dracula meant very little to Stoker. It was the drama end of things that was his real life.
So Dracula and the book Dracula was only literally that. It was just a book. It was a bit of art that he wrote.
Yeah, it was his... Bram wrote 17 books in all. This was his fourth. He himself always believed in it. And he thought Irving might make, you know, a play of it or whatever, but Irving just wouldn't hear tell of it, because I think Irving, being such a vain man, felt it might overshadow him. So the book, it was a good seller as distinct from a bestseller. And Stoker's mother said this book is one day going to become famous. But it didn't actually become famous until 1930, when the Universal Studios bought the rights and made the first real Dracula film. And from then on, it took off. And Stoker himself was dead at this time, but his wife and his son, they made you know, and a good living off.
Was that film, was that Nosferatu?
No, Nosferatu happened in 1922. Nosferatu was a silent movie, and it was actually a pirated version of Dracula by two Germans. And they kind of let it be known it was based on Dracula, but didn't put the name of the book in, on, you know, on the copyright of the film or whatever. But Stoker's widow copped it, and through the Artists Association, she sued them. And she won the case. She won $5,000 at the time. And crucially, she got the movie banned, and all copies were to be destroyed. Now, we're lucky. A few of them escaped to the United States, and we still have Nosferatu to this day. It was, you know, it was, we were lucky that it survived.
It is indeed. For a silent film, Nosferatu is just so scary. It's brilliantly, brilliantly shot.
Well, absolutely, it's a wonderful film, and you know that it was sort of remade in recent years, but it's a classic, no question about it.
Totally, total classic. But I have to pick you up on a little bit of what you said. Merino Crescent is in Fairview, not Clontarf.
Right.
You have to go past that bridge.
Yeah. Well, now let me explain. The whole area originally, I've written a history of Clontarf, so I've studied it a fair bit. The whole area was actually Clontarf. Marina would have been, you know, the present day Marina would have been part of that. Now, I'm going way back. It was when Lord Charlemont took over the Charlemont estate, which covers the present day Marina housing estate, not crucially the Crescent, and up towards the Malahide Road beside Clontarf Golf Course and that. And he called the estate, he inherited it, he called it Marina because he had been sent as a young man, Charlemont, he had a gambling problem. And he had been sent to Italy so that he wouldn't be gambling with these heavy gamblers in Dublin or whatever. And he called the Marina, when he came back, the estate Marino, after a little town beside the sea in Italy. So that's where the Marina name came in. Fairview is the name in its own right, just from the Fairview. But can I tell you a little story about the Crescent? It's a very interesting story and you know, a very good story as far as I'm concerned. I mentioned gambling there. Charlemont's mansion was where sort of St. Joseph's School is in Fairview now, just inland from there. And he had a clear view of the sea. Now, you'll have to picture, if you know the area, there was no Fairview Park, that's all reclaimed, mm-hmm. No railway line going across.
Yeah, it was coming.
But yeah. Open sea, and he view right out to Howth and the Dublin and Wicklow Mountains on the other side and the sea. But he had a gambling bet with a guy called, he was from the south side, his name will come to me in a minute. And he didn't realise that, I'll get his name in a second. Anyway, they had a gambling bet, and a Charlemont accused the other guy of being betting beyond his means, that he wasn't able to back up the bet. And this annoyed
the other gentleman.
His name just won't come to me. So Charlemont didn't know the other guy had bought a stripe of land along the sea. Now, the sea came right up to where Merino Crescent is today, or we call it the Crescent. And he had applied for housing, to build houses, a row of cottages. And he was going to build cottages, but this annoyed him, being accused of not being able to back up his bet, and he had money. So he reapplied. Charlemont didn't know about it. He reapplied to build the Crescent as it is today, to block Charlemont's view of the sea. The saga, Charlemont found out, and there was another twist to the story. Charlemont owned the toll gates coming into Fairview area, so he said he put the fees so high on the building materials, he still can't get that name, that the man was bringing in, that it would be uneconomical for him to build there. So our friend thought it out, and what did he do? He hired a set of barges, and he brought the goods free of charge across from Rings Inn, across the sea, straight into Clontarf, and he built the Crescent in the shape and size it is now, to block the view of the sea. Charlemont took it to the House of Commons to say that he was being blocked of view, and the Commons rule, it's still a rule to this day, that you're not entitled to a view. If you were blocking your light or something, fair enough, but you're not entitled to a view. So Charlemont won the case, and the Crescent is still known to this day as the most expensive spite fence or hate fence in Ireland.
That's very good. I knew about it being built to block the view of Lord Charlemont. And actually, my family moved to Fairview in 1906.
All right,
so and to Phillipsburg Avenue.
All right, yeah.
So I have a fair idea that the history, like my when my mother was growing up, the scheme, as they call it, in Marina was only being built.
It was one of the earliest of the Free State, the earliest, I think. So
it was, yeah. And
to alleviate the...
And it was done by...
Cities that are crowding.
Yeah, it was designed and, we'll say, project managed by German town planners. That's why it's yeah. Anybody who doesn't know Marino or doesn't know the scheme in Marino, it's well worth going and having a walk around it, because every turn you make...
Yeah.
Houses are slightly different.
Yeah.
Some of them are dramatically different, but
the very layout of the whole thing.
Totally, and there's the small little things. Yeah, is that one will have a square window and the other will have a round window beside the door, you know, and things. It's just amazing the difference, and have the slates coming down to the.
Folliot was the guy I was trying to think of. Wild Bill Folliot was the guy that Charlemont had the row with. Folliot. Now you mentioned the windows. If you go to the back of the Crescent Houses, you mentioned Charlemont was a very artistic person, and to drive him crazy altogether, Folliot put windows in the back of those houses, and they're there to this day. Some of them were square, oblong, round, moon-shaped, and all over the place. And this just drove Charlemont crazy, so he built a whole line of trees to block view of the back of the houses. So he remembered Wild Bill Folliot for a long time.
No, what I was going to ask you is that we were talking earlier about where did the idea of Dracula come from for Bram? You know, as I said, and I know you're a Sligo man yourself. Where you know, I heard it was about coming from the great cholera epidemic in Sligo.
Well, now let me start at the beginning. Most people around the world are told, indeed indoctrinated into believing, that Stoker's Dracula is based on a guy called Vlad the Impaler. Vlad the Impaler was a 15th century ruler in Romania. And he was a bit of a hero because he was forever fighting the Muslims, the Turks and so on. But he was a guy who put it as a bit of a sadist, really. When he fought a battle or won a war or whatever, he'd capture a certain amount of prisoners of war, and he'd march them back to his encampment. Now his encampment was surrounded by wooden stakes with pointed edges, and while he and a soldier sat down and drank and sang to their victory, he ordered the prisoners of war to be impaled through their belly buttons and so on these pointed stakes. This wasn't a nice guy. Now that's not a vampire, that's a sadist, and there's an awful difference. He was a guy who loved to see people gorge in their own blood, and the crueler the better. Now, Stoker created a creature who needed human blood to survive. Vlad the Impaler did not drink blood. Dracula does. So to me, there's absolutely no connection between it in any sense or form with Vlad the Impaler. In any case, Stoker himself was never in Transylvania in his life. He was, in fact, only in Europe, as far as I know, twice. Once to bury his father in Naples in Italy, and once to visit Oscar Wilde in Paris. Now, to go back to your question, I've published a little book a couple of years ago, and I point out about at least 20, 30 Irish origins of Dracula. Because I say any writer will always go back, I try to write a little bit myself, you'll go back to your formative years. Now, Stoker didn't leave Dublin until he was 31 years old. Now, your formative years are well behind you at that stage. I would call the formative years from birth to about 21. And this story was in his mind, and I think it could only have been written by somebody who was born and reared in the island of that time, the 19th century. Now, one of the main origins, we think, is a story his mother told him of the cholera, the famous cholera epidemic that hit Sligo, the Sligo Mayo area in the year 1832. This cholera came across from the Yellow Sea area in Asia, right across Asia and Europe into Britain and Ireland. Now, as it petered out into the Atlantic, in the Mayo, Sligo, Donegal area, it apparently was at its worst, and people were inflicted with this cholera, and there was no cure. So Bram's mother, she was a little girl at the time, 14, 15 years of age, born and reared in Sligo, and she saw this, literally saw it, and left it in writing, that people suffering from the cholera she thought big pits or graves being dug, and they were physically pushed in with, you know, you'd hold a handle or something, or a stick or a brush or something, and push people in and bury them alive. Now, we think, with Stoker's imagination, he may have seen these people who were buried so unjustly while still alive coming back as vampires to wreak revenge on mankind. And he created the word undead. And we say, well, you can't be undead. You're either dead or alive. But he says, no, the vampire is dead during the day but comes alive at night. That's just one of the stories. A huge one, I think, is...
Just before you go, for I can see that, and I can then see where the idea of the wooden stake comes from there. If you're using a pole to push people in, it's shoving, it's sticking them with a wooden stake.
I don't know where back.
Yeah.
a huge area, now, you know, in Irish life was the famine. The famine changed Ireland forever, the great famine of the 1840s. And I think the Dracula story could well be based on the famine as well. Look at it this way. In those years, every village and town in small town in Ireland had what was called, known as the big house. And the landlord lived in the big house, kind of overlooking the village. And we could say that Stoker was a civil servant, and he saw that Ireland was actually, British rule was administered in Ireland through the landlord system. The landlord was usually the local member of parliament. He was the landlord. He rented out the land to the peasants, so he more or less owned them. And he appointed the JP, the Justice
Peace,
or whatever, for the area. So he effectively was British. Now, Bram didn't like this. So we say that, metaphorically speaking, he saw the landlord sucking the blood of the peasants from his palace. Now, conversely, if you were a peasant and, you know, you were starving and you were travelling the roads or by roads, sideways roads in Ireland, for a couple of weeks, what's going to happen? Well, the pallor comes to your face, the blood drops, and you get that candle waxing look. The skin retracts, and the teeth, these teeth come out, and you might only have an old coat or a cloak around you. Isn't that the vampire too? So what I'm saying is, the vampire could be the landlord or the landlord's victim. So, you know, I keep repeating that Stoker didn't have to put a foot outside Ireland to get this story. We'll take another one. Suicide. Suicide still has a certain stigma, you know, in Ireland, but up to Stoker's time, it was believed that if you committed suicide, you actually became a vampire, unless you got what was called the treatment, that's the stake that you mentioned a minute ago, through the heart. And if you got that and you were buried, you were at peace. But if you didn't, you were deemed to become a vampire, to be out there unloved and unwanted for eternity, haunting mankind, sucking blood. Now, these people weren't allowed to be buried in consecrated ground. There were what we call suicide plots. And there was one of these plots beside Stoker's house in Fairview. It's still there if you know the area well. If you're going from Fairview to Croke Park, you turn right up Clonliffe Road. On the left-hand side, the Clonliffe Road junction with Summerhill, Ballybah, is a plot. And there's a little garden there now. That was a suicide grave. And we know that Stoker spent many hours in there, and with his vivid imagination, did he see some of these suicide victims buried there, coming back as vampires, haunting mankind because they didn't get the stake through the heart treatment?
Is that just at the end of Clonliffe Road, right on the junction with Ballybock Road?
That's exactly it. You're across from Clonliffe House Pub.
Exactly there. That, you know, when I was growing up, there's been an advertising hoarding there for donkey's years.
That's right.
And I've lived in that. I went to O'Connell School, so I walked up and down that road every day for years.
The haunted ground you were going.
Exactly. Indeed, yeah. I didn't. And I always wondered why it was left there, because there's a little shop just on the Ballybock Road side of that, and I always wondered, you know, why did they never spread across? Why didn't they make the place bigger?
Yeah. Is the shop you're referring to Malarkey's, by any chance?
Pardon?
Was that shop called Malarkey's?
I'm not too sure. It could have been. So, to me, you know, as a child, it was a shop. And
you didn't worry with it. You have another quick inspiration. You know, St. Mickens Church, St. Mickens, Dublin was pronounced St. Mickens, I think, down in the Keys.
Indeed, yeah.
This church, as you know, its vaults contain bodies that haven't decayed or whatever. By some atmospheric freak, bodies are maintained there as in natural mummification. It's because it's built in peatland, essentially. Now, by the way, there's a vault opened, but there are about 9 vaults under that church. They don't open them for kids that wreck the foundations or whatever. And one of the vaults was owned by the Stokers, the Stoker family. And Bram used to go in there as a child, and no doubt studied with his imagination. He studied these bodies that didn't decay or whatever, and probably got the idea, we think, that, you know, that they were still and dead during the day, but they turned into vampires at night and stalked the area for blood and for maintenance and so on.
These would have been his ancestors.
His own ancestors and others. Like the famous tomb there has the crusader and the nun and
indeed,
and the known
war warrior. There was a bit of devilment there, and somebody went in and robbed.
Sadly, I'd call it more than devilment. It's just vandalism, you know, sadly. But they have it back. That's not the first time that has happened. You know, and it's such a pity. Like,
terrible pity. Dennis is still with us here, and we're going to keep on talking about Bram Stoker's Dracula. Just there in the break, I was asking you, Dennis, are there any other kind of things we identify with Dracula that would link in to the Irish connection?
Well, I think there are many, and this is why I keep arguing that it's a totally Irish book. And, you know, to repeat, Bram never... He didn't leave Ireland until he was 31 years of age. Now, many of the items, the ingredients, the whatever you want to call them, in the story are, you know, straight from Irish folklore and Irish countryside and life in Ireland and general. For example, the vampire is a very cunning creature. A lot of people today see the vampire with a beautiful cloak and purple linings, and he looks the aristocrat and kind of sexy and all that. Believe you me, he isn't like that at all. The smell of his breath alone would paralyse you. He's a mean, wicked, cruel, calculating, callous creature. Now, in the book, in the story, many times he gets cornered. You know, the Van Helsing and the vampire hunters. They form a plan of campaign, which again comes straight from Irish history and the Land League. Some of David's followers formed a plan of campaign, so it's straight from Irish history. Anyway, the form of plan of campaign to capture him or whatever, but very often when he's cornered, he turns himself into something very Irish or something that we were traditionally afraid of. Now, he can become a wolf, and of course Ireland at one stage was full of wolves. Let's talk now about bringing the wolves back again, actually. And you kind of disappear when you see a wolf near you, and again he escapes. Other times he's cornered and he turns it into a rat. Now, you know, we're revulsed by the rat. It's very, you know, darkness and the long, slimy tail or whatever. And of course, you think you're Dracula cornered, and suddenly it's a rat or a gang of rats in front of you. And of course, you're going to get the hell out of there. And he escapes again. A storm is an interesting one. The Irish countryside is full of storms and has been over the years, winter storms and so on and so forth. Now, I come from farming stock myself, and to this day, there's a worry, despite modern technology and everything else, there's a worry that a bad storm in autumn could ruin a summer's work, if you know what I mean. You know, hay and oats and crops generally. And again, when the vampire is in trouble or whatever, he can cause a storm. And when the storm happens, it's an escape route for him. People go indoors and put down the batten the hatches, and he gets away again. So I'm saying all these things are very Irish. The gypsies feature very often in the story, very common. Well, now again, what's more Irish than gypsies? On my way to school every morning in Sligo, and every evening we met gypsies on the road to and from school, and they were just like they are in the vampire story, in Dracula story. They have their, you know, rosary beads and religious symbols in particular, and you know, he didn't have to go to Transylvania to find his gypsies. And talking about the religious end of things, and this is very, very Irish. We know how dominant the Catholic Church was and has been, and probably still is to a certain extent, in Ireland. Now, a lot of people accuse Stoker. The one thing that the vampire is really afraid of is the sacred host. Now, the Church never liked this book because, you know, it introduced something different. Vampirism is something from the East that's different, and it could nearly change our culture if this vampirism thing got out. And a lot of them accused Stoker of kind of vilifying the Church or something. It's not like that at all in my reading. The crucifix and the sacred host are used, you know, to repel the vampire. And it's a strength for the Church, because essentially the Dracula story is good versus evil. And good must always win. And good always does win. The vampire is eventually destroyed back in his castle. Well, until Hollywood resurrected him again and again. But that the religious theme, I don't have to talk about how deep religion runs in Irish society. So he was aware of that and he used it. And as I say, it's one of the very often I'm talking about Stoker and Dracula, people ask me, why don't people know Bram Stoker better? They know Dracula, but they don't know Stoker. Well, the main reason is this. It's not on the school curriculum. Now, you think back of your school days, you met the main writers, the big writers, in school.
Yeah, yeah, Joyce and Shaw and...
You name it.
And Wilde
and of course, all the British writers and so on. But Stoker is not there. Now, I'm not going on a crusade against the church or anything, but I feel, well, the church obviously ran the schools. And they kept this book off the curriculum because they just didn't like it. It was different. You know, now, it's not, when I say it's not associated with Halloween, it's not the same type of Halloween stuff as, you know, you're dressing up and Halloween night is essentially when the dead were allowed to come back to get revenge on their people who treated them badly in life. And they were so scary, we dressed up to scare them away. And that's where the dressing up came from. But Dracula is slightly different. And as to go back, it hasn't been on the school curriculum. And that's why we're not familiar with Stoker. And well, we know Dracula from the films. But we're not familiar with the origins of Dracula.
It's funny that what you've been saying there is that I would think probably the best vampire book, Leaving Dracula aside, we said that's the pinnacle. So,
yeah, the prototype.
The next one to that would have been Stephen King's Salem's Lot.
Yeah.
And he really made the vampire out to be so disgusting.
Yeah.
You know, if I remember correctly, he was talking about its skin. Kind of nearly crawled with worms and was slimy and was really repulsive. And just as you said about the smell of the breath, the smell of it, everything, anything it touched kind of stagnated and that.
You're absolutely right. Stephen King gets it spot on. And you'd need to read the Dracula book. He's not quite as stark as King can be. But if you read the book, now, the atmosphere in some of the chapters is cutty. Like, you can actually nearly smell the vampire. That doesn't come across in the films. So when people see the vampire, they say, actually, he's not so bad. He drinks a little bit of blood on that, but I wouldn't mind. Read the book, and as I say, he's not as cutting as King, but boy, does the atmosphere, you know. It's cold, and it's callous, and he's there, and he's looking at you. Particularly for women, because, you know, he can mesmerise them. And there's something compelling about him, but he rules you through fear. I often quote...
Compelling and repulsive.
Yeah.
In one.
I often think of what do you call that famous director? He said, why do we tamper with the vampire? Because we like putting our toe into the cold water of fear. You like to chance it. I was born, believe it or not, in a house with a ghost room. Now, this is true. Down in the wild of the Ox Mountains in Sligo.
What is a ghost room?
Well, now, what is a ghost room? There was a room in the house that we believe was haunted. Now, personally, I don't really know, but it was believed there was a presence in that room. Now, some of my brothers and sisters insist they saw shadows, a man, my mother in particular. So the room, anyways, was shut off. We weren't allowed into it. But when I talk about putting your toe in the cold water of fear, I would sneak into that room when I got a chance. Now, it was full of cobwebs and a haunting atmosphere. You really would shake now. You know, it hadn't been decorated in over 100 years. That's the type of thing that comes across in some of the chapters in Dracula. It's chilling. And it's the fear bit that really makes the story, I think.
And just going to go back to Stephen King, one of the other things in it, and it has that religious connotation, the way that you know if a vampire, if one of the vampires is near, is a little bottle of holy water.
Yeah.
It will glow.
Yeah.
You know, if they're anywhere near. So, you know, you get that religious connotation to it.
Oh, sure. And as I say, the church should be in one way proud of that type of thing, because it's the holy water and the crucifix and the sacred host and so on that really are put an end to Dracula. He has no answer to the power of the church, the the host and so on.
Now, we better talk about your book. You released that a couple of years ago.
Yeah, 2 years ago. Well, to be honest, I was sick and tired of this story of Vlad the Impaler being... Just people said, well, Dracula's based on Vlad the Impaler, end of story, move on, next subject. Now, I said, this is simply not true. Because it started with me. I came to Clontarf in the early 70s as a young teacher, ambitious. And I'm a very nosy person. And, you know, I started doing projects with my class and different classes. I had to do projects on all the churches in the area, all the schools in the area, famous events in the area, famous people in the area. And somebody eventually said to me, well, why don't you write a book and put it all together? So I did. I published a history of Clontarf. But one chapter in that book dealt with the famous people. And that's when I first met Bram Stoker. And I took a look at Bram Stoker and Dracula. And I looked up. Jesus, I said, here we have a guy in our hands that nobody knows. He's written the biggest selling novel ever written in any language anywhere in the world. Only the Bible outsells it. We checked with Hollywood. They said they can trace 1,000 major films inspired in some way by Dracula. And it went on and on. It has never been out of print, printed in every language in the world, including Irish. There was a 1933 edition by Sean O'Kearine. And I said, here's a guy we don't even know about him. So, right, I said, we set up a Bram Stoker organisation, and I gathered all I could of the Irish stuff, and I put it all together, and it deals with his childhood, his years in Trinity College, his years as a civil servant, his years... And people often say he didn't know the Irish people. Did he not? His job in the civil service, he was a secretary of the petty sessions, which were the courts, and then he was promoted to inspector. And that meant he had to go around the country to all the court sessions, and there'd be about maybe 10 or 15 sitters around the country. And he travelled walking, cycling, by train, and by an Cody car. And he was in every corner of the country. And going back to the Sligo area, many people know this, but his mother actually worked in a big house called Longford House. And that's, you know, the story itself is very upstairs, downstairs, Dracula. There's no middle class, more or less. You're either up here or you're a peasant. And we think his visits to Sligo, in particular, the Wild Ox Mountains, which I know so well, behind Longford House, down there near about 10 miles from Sligo Town, and the little mountain roads. People say, oh, Stoker got the mountain roads in Transylvania, so right. They aren't the mountain roads in Transylvania. They're the mountain roads of the mountains of Ireland. What's the difference between a mountain road in Sligo or Kerry or Cork or Transylvania? You might have different vegetation. And OK, though, you might have to turn the sheep into wolves. But essentially, these were the roads he travelled. And that's where his mountains come from, you know. And the more you go into it, it couldn't have been written by anybody else, only somebody who lived in this type of an Ireland at the time.
And before Stoker wrote about Dracula, what was vampires?
Well, the vampire was always with us. Go back to Chinese, ancient Egypt, all that, there was always a vampire. Now, the myth of the modern vampire, and people often say, well, look at this story you set in Transylvania. Well, it is, and it is, in the sense that the myth of the modern vampire did emulate. If you put a kind of a horseshoe around the Carpathian Mountains, right in the middle of Europe, there, well, Eastern Europe, including Transylvania, and you know there are loads of stories of, you know, people coming out of graves and all the murdering and this kind of thing. And Bram obviously picked up on a bit of that, and he did set part of his story there for one reason only. I think it wouldn't have been accepted. It was fashionable. As a true vampire story, unless part of it belonged to that myth of that. But the vampire was there. He didn't create the first vampire, but he created the vampire, the prototype vampire, the one that lasted. When you think of a vampire now, you think of Dracula. When you think of Dracula, you think of the vampire. So it was the real one. And the other point about the book is, if you study, have you been, any of you been to Whitby? He brings the vampire ashore at Whitby, which is a little seaside town in Yorkshire, sure, in England, because yeah. He used to go on holidays there. But if you study it, as I have, it's not Whitby, it's Clontarf. All the ingredients in the story are where he grew up. There's the old abbey, there's the crescent, there's the river, there's the pier, which is the Bull Wall, the sea itself, of course, even the storm southwesterly. Clontarf is notorious for southwesterly gales. Every ingredient of that is the Clontarf he grew up in. Not today's Clontarf now, because the whole seafront has changed.
Indeed. And that's what
and the castle, of course, Clontarf Castle is there.
That's what a lot of people don't think of when you see modern day Fairview, Clontarf, is that it was all a landfill.
Absolutely. Like,
it was all the rubbish from Dublin City basically was dumped there, and then they put clay on top of it.
From the Custom House out, Beresford Place, right out Amiens Street, the North Strand, Fairview Park, of course, Fairview South, the Promenade, right out to sun. It's all infill, it's all reclaimed. And not that long ago, Fairview Park was only finally filled in 1924.
Well, that's right. That's what sent my mother.
Yeah. I remember well. Yeah.
She was born in 1920, but she did mention that she did remember being down there, and it was, I don't think the sea was there. It was in the state of being reclaimed.
Yeah. And when I was researching the history of Clontarf, there were quite many people. The promenade wasn't finally finished until the 1960s, but their abiding memory was the smell. You see, they built two walls, and that to suction out mud and dead fish and so on and so forth. Now, some of them, they didn't put Dracula to shame for the stench of the place. And they did suffer for years and years. And then it was infilled with sooty rubbish, sand on top, and then grass. And I mean, it looks beautiful now.
Yeah. Well, then, if you can do go out to Dollymount, and if you dig down in the sand, you know, at the top you have that lovely, you know, that kind of golden sand, and it gets wet. Yeah. But you dig down into that, and suddenly it becomes black.
Yeah.
And it smells to high heaven.
Yeah, it's rubbish. It's rotting rubbish. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's all the dead worms, the dead fish, and all that is all.
Yeah,
it's all there.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say about Dracula, we're saying that the ideas came from both Clontarf, where he was brought up, and also from his mother. Mm-hmm. Where she was brought up in Sligo, and all the things that happened, and and of course his own life travelling round, for the courts, and all that came together.
It all coalesced in his mind.
In his mind.
To form the Dracula story,
What were the other books that he wrote?
Well, he wrote something in all. The one I like best, I would, because I'm biased, it's set in the west of Ireland. And in fact, I'm glad you brought that up. It has a character called Black Murdoch. Now, Black Murdoch is a money lender, and by Jesus, they're still with us, believe you. You know the type that comes along and takes a mother's children's allowance book and holds on to it. This Black Murdoch, it's set in the west of Ireland, you're probably the Belfast Sligo area, but that's not that important. But Murdoch, a money lender, will lend you money, but he never lets you fully pay it back. He'll find some reason that you owe him some art to lend you more. The idea is to get you into such debt that he can grab everything belonging to you. Now, this Black Murdoch is typical. He gets stuck into this family, Joyce is their name, and he lends them some money, but of course they fail to pay it back, and he lends them more and more. So he eventually takes their furniture, little house and property, whatever little farm they had. Now, and he's called a Gombeen man. Now, is Dracula not one step further? Not alone does he want your property and everything else, he wants your very life's blood as well. A bit like Shylock in The Merchant of Venice or something. Mm. You know, I think it's a step on. That would probably be... He had another book that was made into a film. It's set in... the name escapes me now. It's set in the Midlands of England. The Lair of the White Worm.
I've heard of it,
That was made into a film. And he has one on Egypt, which actually... When Bram, before Bram married Florence Malcolm, she was courted by a guy called Oscar Wilde. Now, you can say, look what she missed or whatever. But anyway, Oscar didn't go to England. He was very upset that Florence didn't marry him. And he had given her a little crucifix with his name inscribed on it. And he demanded the crucifix back, which I thought was very mean. I mean, God damn it, if you give a girl a present, you leave it to her. But anyways, she eventually married Bram, probably encouraged by her parents, because Bram looked the, you know, settled, you know, civil servant and so on and so forth.
Good prospects.
But he had some kind of set life. Now, Oscar said, Bram became very close friends of the Wilds. And remember, you had an island, a Dublin that time, that was bereft of an upper class because the Act of Union had taken the aristocracy out of Dublin, the MPs and the landlords. And you got the term the absentee landlord. They were all in London, and Dublin became, you know, it used to be the second city of the empire. It now became a bit derelict and run down and lacking an aristocratic class. Now, the Stokers and the Wilds would have become sort of the aristocrats of the city. And Bram got to know the Wilds, and William Wilde was an Egyptian scholar. And one of his last books was inspired by Wilde, based in Egypt. But apart from those two, the rest of them are, half his books are what you call romantic, which you don't really associate with Stoker. And the rest are of the vampire type stuff, about half and half. But really, he's heavy going. He's black and white. There's very little shades of grey with Stoker. Now, I wouldn't put him in the Joyce or any or Yeats League, but he outsells the two of them put together. Indeed. One book, Dracula.
Dennis, unfortunately, we're running out of time here, and we're going to have to go. I absolutely enjoyed chatting with you. Where can people get that book if they want it? First of all, tell us the name of it.
The name of it is Bram Stoker and the Irishness of Dracula. And for people immediately local, the Spar Shop in Vernon Avenue in Clontarf. Otherwise, they'll come to us and I can give you an email or whatever, direct from ourselves. Okay,
give us the email.
And the email is Dublin North Bay Tourism at hotmail.com.
Gmail.com,
I'll say it again.
Dublin North Bay Tourism at gmail.com.
Give the thing and we'll look after you.
Dennis, thank you very much for chatting with me.